From KDNK Community Access Radio in Carbondale, Colorado, in the United States, this is program number 66 of The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. When blind people go places, we don't experience them like our sighted friends. We don't see beautiful mountains or romantic sunsets. The goal of this program is to identify and even create experiences that are more meaningful or just more fun for us and for our sighted traveling companions. Frequently, as people lose their eyesight, they become more and more isolated. The Tactile Traveler hopes to empower people not only to go literally around the world, but around the block to new adventures in their lives. Blind ranges from people who are visually impaired, and glasses and contact lenses no longer allow them to lead a normal life, to people like me, who are totally blind, to sighted parents who have a blind child, blind parents who have sighted children, blind parents with blind children, and people of all ages, interests, and physical abilities. On today's program, protecting our guide dogs, pets, and us from smoke from forest fires and wildland fires. Tell your anesthesiologist if you use marijuana, if you're having surgery or a colonoscopy, how blind people and people with low vision can shoot videos, and the passing of Leslie Steffens. Between global warming and a dry winter in many parts of the United States and the world, conditions are ideal for forest fires and wildland fires. Wildland fires are similar to forest fires, which take place in less densely wooded areas and may include rural areas and communities. And where there's fire, there's smoke. But when there's smoke, there isn't necessarily fire, because smoke can travel thousands of miles, exposing us and our service animals like guide dogs to health risks.
Long-range smoke, smoke from far away, often it doesn't smell like smoke. And so and when we know that there's a fire and maybe we can see it and we can certainly smell it in the air, people are definitely more aware and more likely to think about the actions they should take to protect themselves, but also their pets. But that long-range transport smoke often doesn't smell like smoke. It just maybe looks a little hazy out there. So I think raising the awareness about air quality in general is really important.
That's Colleen Duncan, professor of veterinary medicine at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. She has expertise in how outdoor air affects pets.
And so the recommendations in there for people, I can say with my veterinarian hat on, a really good starting place to think about what to do with your pet. So absolutely, guide dogs have to be outside to do their job.
Colleen says the air quality index can tell us how bad the smoke is that we can't see, but can still affect our health.
The first thing that is really important to get some familiarity with is the air quality index, or the AQI. Thankfully, this is actually a category, a system that was developed for people, but as a veterinarian, I can say it's a really helpful starting place for animals as well. And so air quality is monitored, air pollution is monitored, and now it's increasingly easy to access information. We often hear it on the radio, weather report, or it would be available, online. You can look it up. You can get apps on your phone. But what they do is the goal is to try to sort of classify the air pollution or the air quality risk to people in a fairly straightforward way.
The AC1 measures ground level ozone and particle pollution, also known as particulate matter, including PM2.5 and PM10, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide with both a color and numerical index. Green is good. 0 to 50, air quality is satisfactory, and air pollution causes little or no risk. Yellow is moderate, 51 to 100. Air quality is acceptable. However, there may be a risk for some people, particularly those who are unusually sensitive to air pollution. Orange is unhealthy for sensitive groups, 101 to 150. Members of sensitive groups may experience health effects, but the general public is less likely to be affected. Red is unhealthy, 151 to 200. Some members of the general public may experience health effects. Members of sensitive groups may experience more serious health effects. Purple is very unhealthy, 201 to 300. Health alert. The risk of health effects is increased for everyone. Maroon is hazardous, 301 and higher. Health warnings of emergency conditions. Everyone is more likely to be affected. Face masks may help us when the air's polluted, but they really don't have any for most dogs.
There are some masks that are made for dogs that sort of have unique jobs, but they're not widely available commercially. And so the best thing that we can do, unfortunately, is to think about modifying behavior and our exposure as we go outside. So little things like another really important air pollutant is ground level ozone. And we know that ozone, for example, builds up throughout the day. And so if there are particular activities that you know have to get done, and maybe they're a bit more flexible, we could think about things like doing those in the morning when the ozone risk is a lot lower than it is as it builds up through the day. And for animals, that's actually really helpful too from a temperature standpoint, because oftentimes the temperature is making the air quality worse and the temperature itself is a little bit of a stressor on the body. So there's added benefit of if you can cluster some of those activities, the optional activities or the flexible activities to earlier in the day, that can also really reduce exposure.
Colleen says the more active your outdoor activities are, the earlier you should do them.
That would be one sort of a very doable thing. If there are activities that could happen at any time of day and they require being outside, and also perhaps if they require more exertion, like there's a longer distance to walk, for example. Air pollution, effectively the dose of air pollution you take in depends on how heavily, how deeply you breathe, in addition, and the time you've been outside, in addition to the level of pollution in the air. So for example, if you want to go running, you're going to be taking big, deep breaths. You're going to be breathing at a higher respiratory rate. You're going to get a higher effective dose of pollution if you go running versus if you just go walking. So if we think about things like, oh, well, doing that particular task involves not just maybe more time outside, but more exertion. That's another way we can think about modifying our behaviors.
Colleen says, if you have dogs with flat noses, keep their exposure to polluted air to an absolute minimum.
We know that some dog breeds are more at risk of air pollution and extreme heat, for example. So dogs with the flat face that generally are at risk of respiratory type conditions anyway. They have difficulty breathing based on how they're built. They're going to be more prone to having sort of wildfire smoke in the area or bad air pollution days.
If you bring guide dogs or pet dogs inside your home to get away from the outside smoke, where people smoke tobacco or marijuana, your dogs will be exposed to a different kind of pollution. Since both kinds of smoke are heavier than air, they settle on carpets and furniture, where children and pets spend a lot of time.
Human health standpoint, but absolutely marijuana smoke can affect pets. One of the things that some of the poison what get a lot of calls about actually is animals that sort of get the secondary toxicity or secondary exposure because of household recreational use. And I think it's sometimes important when we think about smoke exposure of whatever type to animals is that they can't communicate to us if it makes them feel a little bit crummy, right? So these pet hotline calls might be about some sort of very high level of exposure, or we're seeing really severe symptoms in an animal. But I think it's really important to think about long-term exposure to lower levels of pollution, whatever the source. And that's one of the things that for me as a veterinarian, I've been increasingly interested in is what happens with chronic exposure? Now, in people, they've done some really fascinating studies looking at the impact of air pollution on things like cognitive function. People have done great studies like looking at people's chess playing ability under conditions of air pollution, or ability to make decisions in sporting events that require some strategy. And it's shown that all of those can be impaired by air pollution. So if we think about like our assistance dogs that have really, really important jobs, and if they're similarly affected sort of by even lower levels, chronic low levels, and it affects their ability to make decisions, their ability to do their job, or perhaps their overall lifespan, that's a really important thing to think about too. Not just these really intense, short, what we call acute exposure events, like in one wildfire season or one particularly smoky household. But how can we prevent this chronic long-term exposure so that service dogs can really do the jobs that they have been trained for?
The Denver Public Library and Lauren Mingus helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. If you use marijuana and you're going on a trip to the hospital for surgery or even something as simple as a colonoscopy, be sure to tell your doctor and anesthesiologist that you use marijuana.
Actually, that's crucial, and that's what we really want people to know.
That's Dr. Jennifer Coleman, an anesthesiologist and senior medical director for anesthesia at University of Colorado Health in Southern Colorado. Dr. Coleman says marijuana use will affect how much, sometimes up to 10 times as much anesthesia that you will need to stay asleep during surgery, and how you feel and how you'll need to be treated after you wake up.
Everyone is different, and it really depends on the person, their own metabolism of the medications and their own pain tolerance. It depends on what they're having done. But our experience is that in general, for the vast majority of marijuana users, if we don't make adjustments to the medications that we're giving and the things that we're doing for them, they have a harder time after surgery.
Here in Colorado, anyone over 18 can legally use marijuana. But it's equally important to tell your doctors if you use marijuana in states where it isn't yet legal.
Physicians really aren't going to turn them into the cops if they use marijuana or any other recreational drug. What we want to do is provide the best medical care possible for each person. And so if people are really upfront with us about how much they use and when they've last used it, we can really tailor the care to help decrease negative outcomes. We can make sure that we have alternate plans for pain control so that if opioid medications aren't working, we can shift to something else or even start off with something else so that they don't have as much pain when they're waking up. We can also plan to treat the nausea that can occur after surgery in marijuana users. And then when people are up on the floor after surgery, say they've had a larger surgery and they're going to stay in the hospital for a few days, we can watch for cannabis withdrawal syndrome, which causes really unpleasant side effects for them and can look like other problems like infection or cardiac arrest, early cardiac arrest. If we don't know what we're looking at, symptoms like restlessness, abdominal pain, fever, chills, sweating, headache, change in their persona, basically getting very irritable and angry.
Dr. Coleman says she will figure out if you use marijuana when she begins putting you to sleep. But then she will order a special monitor, which isn't usually in the operating room. And she'll have to order extra medicine from the pharmacy.
Funny, it can require either more or less. And a lot of that depends on when that person last used and kind of the chronicity of their use. So personally, I like to use a brainwave monitor to help me tell exactly how asleep that person is so that I can hover them in the consciousness zone that will work best for them using the right amount of anesthesia. And if I know that someone is using, then I can hook up that machine because it's not something I would use on everyone and really tailor their anesthesia to them.
Depending on the hospital, if you have insurance and your copay, you may be billed by the minute for your time in surgery. And those extra minutes you could have avoided. Dr. Coleman says it doesn't matter how you use marijuana.
This all applies regardless of how people use marijuana, whether it's a tincture, whether they're smoking, or using oral. It all works out the same.
Dr. Coleman also says she asked teenagers, again in the operating room away from their parents, if they use marijuana before starting the surgery. She recommends talking to your doctor and anesthesiologist in advance of surgery about tapering off your use.
Right now, there isn't a set guideline for tapering or stopping use prior to surgery. What we definitely recommend is that people don't use marijuana the day of their surgery, because if their mind is altered, then we can't really get consent. And if it's an elective surgery, we may cancel the surgery because legally we can't get a good consent that's acceptable. But what I do recommend is that patients talk to their surgeon beforehand, and they can then determine how they would like to taper or how far out they would like to stop based on the surgery they're having and their other medical problems. Even if you haven't used it in a week, still let your anesthesiologist or your surgeon know about it so that we can make adjustments. Really, the main point that we want to get across is it's just important to communicate with your healthcare providers. We really just want to do what's best for you. And we really want to make sure that you have the best experience that you can have when you come through our doors. So the more information that you can give us about what you're using and how much and how often, the more we can do to be that good experience. We know that we often see people on some of the worst days of their lives. And if we can do even a little thing to make it better for them and to reduce the pain a little bit and reduce the nausea and make sure that their surgical experience is good, then that's really what we want to do.
You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Since blind people like to share their vacations with their family and friends like everyone else, we're rerunning a story by Jason Strother, who figured out how blind people can shoot videos.
As a freelance journalist, I need to tell stories in as many ways as possible, including in print, audio, and video. But as someone who's legally blind, my vision is something like 20 over 300. Capturing good quality images doesn't come easy. Recently, I picked up a GoPro camera, and no, the good folks at GoPro are not paying me to plug their gadget. Let me turn it on. It's a tiny device. It fits in the palm of your hand, but it has a really wide lens. What's also pretty cool about it is that it's voice activated. GoPro, start video. Now it's recording. Thanks to the big lens, you can point the camera at pretty much anything, and you'll be sure to get it all in frame. Likewise, if you turn the camera around onto yourself and hold it at arm's length, you'll be able to shoot from about your mid-torso up to the top of your head, at least. There's no manual focus on this camera, so everything you shoot comes out pretty clear. And it films up to 4K video, so the quality is pretty much as good as it gets. But the file sizes are pretty big. GoPro, stop video. Like I said, the camera is really small, and I can't really see the viewfinder on the back so well. But the GoPro allows users to stream video onto other devices, so what I do is relay anything that's coming through the lens onto my iPad. And on that, I can see things pretty good, maybe even better than I normally do. Let's watch that video I just shot. I'll hit the play button.
Now it's recording. Thanks to the big lens, you can point the camera at pretty much anything.
Fantastic. I never looked better. The same trick works for taking pictures. GoPro, photo mode. GoPro, take photo. There you go. GoPro, turn off. I need to save battery life. So, with gear like this, you can capture good quality video from your next trip to the beach, to the park, or while you're having lunch. And that's exactly what we all need right now. More videos of people eating. For the Tactile Traveler, I'm Jason Strother.
You're listening to the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. It is with great sorrow that we have to announce the passing of Leslie Steffens. Leslie was the first volunteer to help with this program. I can't read Braille, so when I announce the show, someone has to read my script to me, part of a sentence at a time. Then I repeat it and eventually edit all the parts together. Leslie, who lived about 160 miles from me, dictated my script to me over the phone. For years, Leslie was instrumental in helping me develop the skills to be able to conceive and produce this program. Leslie and I have been friends for more than 50 years. When I began working as a freelance radio reporter, Leslie was working as a television repairman for Sears. He graciously fixed my recording equipment when it broke down. And when my first wife and I split up, he and his wife Barb let me move my radio production studio into their basement, where I produced a weekly radio program for several years and developed the skills to help me conceive and produce the Tactile Traveler. Thank you, Leslie. Leslie is survived by his wife, Barbara, and sons, Paul and Kevin. You're listening to the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Why, it's my talking scale, reminding us that we'd like you to weigh in on how we're doing. Please let us know by sending an email to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. We spell Traveler the American way, with one L. We'd also like to hear your story ideas from all over the world. Please send us an email with story ideas in the subject line to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. Transcripts of this program are available for our deaf listeners by searching The Tactile Traveler in any search engine. This program is also being broadcast on Aftersight, formerly the Audio Information Network of Colorado, and additional audio information networks in additional states. It's also available by typing the Tactile Traveler into any search engine and available wherever you get podcasts. And by asking your smart speaker to play the podcast, The Tactile Traveler. We'd like to thank the following people and organizations that help make today's program possible. Be My Eyes Microsoft Accessibility Tech Support, Apple Accessibility Tech Support, Pat Conroe, Lorraine Hutchinson, Debbie O'Leary, Sarah Williams, Sophia Williams, Cody Lee, Kaylee Romero, Evan Stearns, and Raleigh Burley. This has been The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. This has been a production of KDNK Community Access Radio, Carbondale.